everybody. My name is June O'Sullivan, and today's Talking Early Years podcast is with Catherine Hill. And Catherine is the strategic project manager for 4in10, a question I'll be asking her more about later. And that is part of the London Child Poverty Action Group. So today we're going to talk a lot about child poverty, about what we're trying to do to address it, and also to find out a little bit more about Catherine, and then to have her call to action so that you all join up and support this very important subject. So I'm just going to start by welcoming Catherine and asking her to introduce herself to us all.
Thanks, June. Thank you so much for inviting me to come and take part today. I'm really looking forward to our chat. As you said, my name is Catherine. I'm the manager at 4in10. 4in10 is a network membership organisation which exists to tackle child poverty in London. So all our members, and they are extremely diverse, wide and various, have a shared goal when it comes to wanting to do something about the sky high levels of child poverty in London. So we are made up of some very tiny volunteer led organisations, play groups, food banks, larger campaigning charities, organisations that run service providers like yourselves. We really are anybody and everything. We also have a number of individuals who've joined the network recently, a number of paediatric doctors who are really worried about what they see in terms of the effects of child poverty have joined our ranks. So we are an extremely diverse group, and we come together to campaign, but we also aim to support our members in their work by offering information sharing. We have a very interesting full newsletter that goes out every other week, so we enable peer-to-peer information sharing, and we also offer training in a wide variety of both sort of offering practical support in terms of helping people navigate the benefit system, but also kind of capacity building in terms of campaigning skills and things. So we're doing a lot. And one of the other things that we do is support something where it gets a bit confusing, called the London Child Poverty Alliance, which is a slightly smaller set of organisations who've come together. They came together originally a number of years ago to support the Mayor of London and his endeavours to address child poverty. But the group has evolved and continues to come together to campaign. And particularly in relation to kind of key political moments. So we often produce a manifesto to seek to influence in both local and regional general elections as well.
That's quite, I hope everyone's awake and can taking that in, because there's a lot of detail in that answer. It seems such a simple question, like, who are you? And you know, we've been involved with you guys for a long time. Child poverty is sadly an issue that we address in our through our business model, but also in our daily experiences. I hadn't realized your newsletter was as often as fortnightly. That's pretty good. Will you give us the link to that when we send this podcast out?
Yes, of course. And yeah, I really would urge your listeners to sign up to it, because it's a really good source of information and useful for anyone who's looking to advertise jobs or use us in some way to sort of get your messages out there too.
Absolutely, because often it's just, there's so many statistics around some of this stuff. But I'm going to ask you, and this isn't an exam question, Catherine, I promise you, but you know, say for example, and I'm not sure how you feel about this, but if you were in a lift with our Prime Minister and you had three at the most, 30 seconds with him probably to kind of get before him the three big statistics around poverty, what would you say?
I mean, our focus is on London, so I will focus on being in a lift in London. So I would tell him that, it is a truly shocking fact that 4in10 children in the capital grow up in poverty, and in some areas of the city it's more than that. In some inner London boroughs, such as Tower Hamlets, the figure reaches over 50%. And even in the leafy outer boroughs of the sort that he might represent, there are pockets still where there are very high levels of deprivation. So this is not a marginal issue. It's something that ought to be keeping him awake at night. In terms of other statistics, I suppose I'd say one that always gets me is the fact that 86,000 children are currently living in temporary accommodation in the city. That's, I tried to work this out, and that's nearly sort of 3,000 class, nearly 3,000 classes of 30 children who don't have a home that they can call their own, that is home, that is somewhere that's safe and secure for them. And I suppose if I had to pick a third, I get them to focus on what the impact of poverty is. You know, it's hugely multidimensional. I could take the rest of your podcast statistics, but one that's particularly stands out is that children experiencing poverty, who experience poverty in childhood, are four times more likely to experience mental health problems in later life. So the impacts are, you know, absolutely on people's health, their lifetime opportunities. It's both a question of how it affects them as children here today, but also through their lives.
I'm going to be really rude now and ask you to do your third point again, because the phone went and I couldn't turn it off quick enough, and I will be absolutely slaughtered by him for letting the phone on. So the first two points were really clear. Yeah. 86,000 in temporary living accommodation. But if you just do the third point again, that would be brilliant.
Yeah. So, and the third fact I'd choose would be just an illustration, really, of one dimension of the impact of child poverty, is that four times the number of children who experience poverty in childhood will go on to experience mental health problems later in life, as compared with children who don't live in poverty. Like I said, that's just one example. You could pick any other dimension of life and probably find similar stats, but I just pull that one out.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking though, isn't it, when you think about the implications that has in the longer term. And I mean, there's quite a lot of talk about mental ill health at the moment. I trained as a psychiatric nurse at the Maudsley when I was 18. And, you know, I'm not sure that people have really grasped the issue of mental health at all. And I think it's almost become like a buzzword now, and it's been thrown around all over the place. But, you know, you're talking here about potentially children growing up with the kind of weight on their shoulders that means that they may well not be able to secure decent relationships, build confidence to become long-term employed, may well end up in prison. You're talking about that. I mean, when you translate that, that's what we're talking about here, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think, you know, the other way, you know, if you think that's the mental health side of things. If you think about physical health, we know that, you know, it's become painfully acutely apparent that where people have died most of COVID, it's been in areas where there have been highest levels of deprivation. So, you know, in that sense, you can say, you know, very accurately that poverty is a killer. You know, you're more likely to die if you live in poverty, and certainly in relation to COVID.
Gosh, I mean, there's nothing surprising by that, but we're saying that, and it's 2022. That I think is the bit that's really like crazy. Yep. Crazy.
And it's right under our noses. You know, I think these statistics are, you know, if you work like you're an idea sort of in these sort of areas, you hear them a lot. And, you know, what our role is, I think, certainly in terms of 4 in 10 and the London Child Poverty Alliance, is to make sure people don't lose their ability to be shocked by those figures and those facts.
Yeah, and but there are, I mean, there's still a lot of cynicism about it, because, you know, if you ask, you know, the Clapham omnibus kind of question, you know, do you see poverty in this city? And people will say to you, well, I see children with shoes and clothes. I don't see children starving, you know, like you would see in other parts of the world, you know. So how do you get the message across that, you know, what we mean by poverty, and that notion of, you know, proportion of income as a sort of baseline? And what is the kind of what is the sort of narrative to the you know, the cynic in the street that doesn't see a child literally like out of a page of a Charles Dickens novel?
I think the most important thing we could do is to listen to people who are having that experience, really. We did a piece of work last summer ahead of last year's London Challenge Poverty Week, where we ran a number of focus groups, listening to people who are currently experiencing poverty in the wake of the pandemic, to sort of understand how life is for them. And I think there were a number of kind of words and themes that came up time and time again around the lack of security, the lack of ability to plan for anything, even when you did have enough money for the next meal, so on. You know, there was always the worry that there wouldn't be for the next week. And I think that's what we're seeing increasingly as you know, we all know that prices are rising and the situation is becoming difficult for everybody. For those kind of on the lowest incomes, it's that persistent insecurity that really grinds people down. And you know, yes, you might see that they have, you know, you might perceive that people have some material goods, but I don't think unless you talk and listen really hard to people living precariously on low incomes, it's easy to grasp the reality of that. So I think in terms of what we can do, you know, certainly what we try and do and what we hope is in our DNA is that, you know, yes, you're listening to me here now, but actually it would be better to be listening to people who are having those experiences right now.
And indeed, that actually is a really good point, because we were listening to parents who came back after COVID, and you know, you referenced the doubling down, which is our attempt to give children free access to 30 hours and a proper meal. And it was really interesting, because those parents, it was insecurity is what they went on about all the time. And I recognize that from just, you know, growing up in my own life and stuff, is just like not being able to have savings. And I think there's some really scary statistics, isn't there, about falling into homelessness. Is it 4 pay packets away from homelessness, or yeah. What is it? Is it that, or?
Well, I wouldn't be able to say accurately, but that sounds very familiar. Yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah, I think that it's not something people are well aware of.
No, and it's like one of the things that when we talked to parents in the summer, and when we decided what we would do would be to create the doubling down, because we wanted to do something real and immediate. It was those, so many of the parents were on those. They call it the gig economy. For me, this doesn't feel anything like gigs. It's basically your Uber drivers and your Deliveroos and your, yeah. I'll give you an hour here and you can get a half an hour there, and there's work coming this way and there's work coming that way. And that reminds me of the olden days when people worked on the docks, and you were, you know, you all lined up in the morning to try and get at work, and one guy would be chosen and another guy wouldn't, and all that sort of stuff. It's that horrible insecurity.
Yeah, it's insecurity. And I think the other theme that came through really strongly from those conversations was that these were people who were in a real variety of ways, had a lot of ambition, they had dreams.
Yes.
They felt that the system, and it was a very systemic thing, they were being thwarted at every turn.
Yeah.
So they absolutely wanted to work. They had things that they really wanted to do that are important to them in terms of, and they felt they were doing all the right things and everything that was asked of them. And yet the system was undermining that and undercutting them. So, you know, if you take your area's kind of specialism around childcare, mm-hmm. I mean, the government's narrative is about how much it's great largesse and how it's expanded in time. But actually, from the point of view of someone seeking to get a job, you know, as a single parent with a one-year-old, there is no entitlement.
No.
And they've been forced to give up a job that they desperately wanted to return to.
Yeah.
And yet there's simply nothing for them, no support at all. And I think they find it very difficult to kind of fathom how the government gets to a point where, you know, in their eyes, they're doing a jolly good job. And in the eyes of the people who are needing to rely on this infrastructure, it's worse than useless.
Yes, and we would agree with you on that. And we would agree on the fantasy that comes from our ministers, you know, narratives. I don't know, it's like it's a fairy story, because the reality is just absolutely different to what's really happening. And you know, in terms of tackling child poverty, are there any initiatives that you've been involved in, or you've kind of know of, that have sort of worked and that we should be really pushing behind And are there some that people sort of knee jerk into that actually sound good, but that never really deliver?
I think I'm going to answer your question in a slightly different way, as it's sort of pointing to specific initiatives. But I think the thing about child poverty is that it is multidimensional. There are lots of different aspects to poverty, both its causes and its effects. And there are good initiatives that seek to tackle elements of those things. You know, we know there's good practice in London. There are some boroughs who've made real efforts, for example, reform their council tax reduction schemes so that you can receive a full reduction, a full rebate, rather than sort of be left to pay 15-20% or something, which you can't afford. So there are definitely actions being taken in boroughs that we would endorse, and we would want to see the other 30 odd boroughs taking up as well. What I think is lacking both at local, regional and national level is a strategic joined up approach to child poverty. It's not something that our politicians seem to want to talk about.
Yes.
They prefer to talk sort of in a piecemeal way about sort of different aspects of that, about social mobility, access to education, and so on and so forth, but not looking at these issues in the round. One of the things we're really urging through the current local election process is to encourage boroughs to think about it in a systemic way, by listening to their citizens, what the real issues are for them, what's driving child poverty in their locality, and address that in a systemic way, really.
Have you got, on the subject of the local elections, can you very simply explain what actually is up for election and not? We've had so many debates with various people about exactly what, because it's not straightforward. And if you can do that, you've done a huge favour to a lot of us living in London, is exactly what's happening and when it is. And have you kind of built a manifesto around that you might want to talk a bit about?
So my understanding is that it's where all the local council positions in London are up for re-election in May. We had the mayoral and London Assembly elections last year. So those are not...
This is the bit that's confusing people, I think.
I see, right. Okay. So I think, yeah, those are not being contested again in May. This is about local councillors to your local council. And we have indeed pulled together a manifesto, which different members of the Alliance have led on different areas of. We're very lucky to have experts in housing issues, in access to sustainable food, childcare and so on. So they have contributed to each of those different issues, and we've pulled together a set of, I think there are roughly a dozen or so key asks that we're asking local councillors to consider. We're also asking them to make a public pledge to commit to working towards a child poverty free London, and then we're hoping that will help us build relationships with incoming councillors that we will then be able to continue to work with over the 4 years that they're in position to really make some tangible difference in these things. A lot of the big levers, big policy levers in terms of child poverty do reside central government, benefit levels and so on are not set locally, but there is still a lot that can be done at local level. I know in relationship we've got a set of asks that you've helped us to develop around childcare, and we do want to encourage local councillors to be thinking creatively and imaginatively in the absence of more strategic direction from central government about what they can do to support more children to be accessing high quality, good, affordable childcare that's accessible, and seeing themselves as having a role in that. So we'll be publishing it imminently. The ink is sort of drying on the text as we speak, so I'm sure we can make it available to anyone listening to this who'd like to come and help us, support us, get it out, get the word out to those who would be elected in May, and get them to sign up to the pledges.
Well, actually, we can try and align this podcast so that the manifesto is linked to it, and that when it goes out, it makes it easier for people.
That would be fantastic. Yeah, that would be great. I mean, certainly we will be soon. So that would be great.
And, you know, I know I'll ask you this anyway. You can always say no, but do you have like the top three manifesto asks in your head, off by heart, like a poem?
Top three. I mean, I think there are four areas. So
top four.
So I mean, they demand action in four key areas. So it's action on income. We know that income, you know, is poverty is about more than income, but it's absolutely about income. If you haven't got enough money to put food on the table, or, or money on your gas meter, you can't escape that. So it's about what local councils can do to enhance individuals' incomes through not taking money out of their pockets, primarily. Action on hunger. We know that obviously a big focus through the pandemic period has been the fact that people have been accessing food banks in ever increasing numbers. I think the aim of our actions that we've set out are very much about eliminating the need for food banks. But while they exist, sort of ensuring that councils are taking cash first approaches to providing people with the means to feed their families. It's really important. You know, people tell us time and time again about the importance of being able to buy your own food and the dignity that provides. People have very diverse needs in terms of their dietary requirements, their cultural part. You know, being able to choose your own food is a kind of fundamental part of feeling a dignified part of society.
I would think
we
want
to be really concentrating on that. Action on housing. I mentioned housing before. Yeah. The need is acute in London. Lots of rhetoric, you know, at all levels of government about house building, providing more houses at social rent, and yet we still continue to see reality very few numbers of new homes coming on stream. So, emphasis on that. We're supporting one of our shelters, a member of the alliance. They are spearheading work to end the age-old no DSS discrimination. So, even people who being frozen out of private renter sector by discriminatory attitudes. And then the fourth area is around childcare.
Oh, good.
Very much sort of following Leaf's lead about trying to see what more can be done to increase entitlements and provision so that families can access the childcare they need.
Well, that would fit, because our theory of change is access to affordable, high quality childcare. I mean, that's the thing. And, you know, we saw that the Duchess of Cambridge popped off to Denmark for a couple of days to learn about theirs. And I wrote a blog on that for Nursery World. But what I was trying to point out in my message really was that the model that we use, the social enterprise model that we use, underpinned by a really strong social pedagogy, is really workable. Like, there's, you know, it can happen. We don't need to go anywhere. There is a model here that works very well, and there's a willingness for people to apply it. So don't you find it frustrating that there are things we could do, very, very small things in some ways, that actually could make such a difference to a child's life, and there's no, I guess there's no kind of, well, public awareness, but also political drive behind that.
Yeah, it's immensely frustrating. And, you know, that's very much the frustration that I was talking about, the people that came forward in the sort of, when we were talking to people, you know, one of the specific asks, you know, like you're saying, a sort of small thing that's easily doable. We know, because people have done it, the GLA have got a scheme where they provide sort of startup money for people who are looking to access childcare to pay for that initial deposit that's so often an it's genius, but it's not that complicated, you know.
Not at all. Yeah. And it works.
Not rocket science.
And we did it before, yeah. And it worked.
Yeah. And it's, you know, not that, you know, it's just common sense, really, that someone who's living on a low income is not sitting on a pot of money that they can just hand over at the drop of a hat. And, you know, that relatively small amount of money is an enormous barrier, you know, to a number of good outcomes. Because the thing I've always felt really strongly about childcare is that it's a kind of, it's a social good in so many different ways. You know, from a policy perspective, it's a win-win-win, isn't it? Because I think, you know, it's it's what it provides to an individual child in terms of, you know, a foundation for life and all the skills and that comes with a quality early years offer. But it's also about what it adds, you know, offers to society, offers to a family to be able to access employment. And as a society, the benefit we gain from that is, you know, presumably pays for itself a hundredfold. So it's that short, you know, like you say, that short-sightedness of that which seems completely obvious.
Agreed. And the deposit scheme that we tested that with the GLA ages years ago, and it worked, and we did it in a small scheme, and it was a real opener of a barrier. And you might say, well, why do nurseries have to have the deposit? Well, when you're operating at, you know, with such a gap between you know, what you need to earn to kind of just pay your staff and what you know, what you get, especially if you're accessing some of the so-called government funding, the gap is so big that even a deposit gives you some cash to keep your business afloat. And, you know, I don't think everybody quite understands that kind of model. But I agree. But the issue of childcare and the dual kind of policy levers for childcare, one to enable people to work and the other to actually provide really good education and care for children, particularly those from disadvantaged families and backgrounds, continually clashes together, the two. But one of the things that I wonder what you could do as a coalition is, how do you think that you could raise public awareness of this, but not in a kind of deficit model, but in a contributory model? I mean, we have created an environment, an economic environment, where both partners in a relationship need to work just to be able to pay the rent, let alone get a mortgage these days. So we have created that sort of society where women have to go back to work more quickly and then want to remain in the workplace. So we have these kind of clashing dynamics, haven't we? We've trained women. We've taken on board that, you know, they're perfectly capable of delivering all sorts of things and working in the workplace and thriving in lots of cases in the workplace. So we accept that. So we put a lot of effort into making sure women are educated, and, you know, and about time too, right? So we've done that. And then we put a barrier before them. So we do some petty stuff around paternity leave, but actually that's not going to make any difference. And then, because we know, and, you know, people listening to this might think, you know, I'm just being sexist. The truth is, I've been in this game for nearly 20 years. And so I have never seen the dominance of men paying the childcare fees or, you know, getting involved in the childcare big decisions. It's always the mother, you know, it generally is. That's not to say dads aren't involved. It's just that it tends to be a mother relationship. And you can all be going chock horror out there and everything else. Oh, it's terrible, 2022, etc. But that's kind of like the reality. So we do that. So we create an opening for women to become part of the workplace because they want to, and we want to encourage it. And then we close the door as soon as they have children, because we also want them to be mothers, and we knew as a society need children. People forget that. And so then we close that door to them. And yet the public doesn't get that at all. And it doesn't seem to understand that, you know, childcare is no longer a private decision within a family. We have created a society that makes it not a private decision in the family. That woman needs, you know, opportunities to go back to work, to keep a roof over her head and her family's head, along with her partner or her husband or whoever. And that needs to happen. And we have created a whole series of barriers around that in terms of the way we talk about childcare publicly. So there's still this perception that it's a private arrangement, we can decide to do it, or it's terribly bad, you know, these little babies going to nursery. But what are they to do? What are people to do? So that was the difference between Denmark and England, I thought, particularly. And I've always thought that, in that there's a kind of Ubuntu kind of society acceptance that, you know, if we create an environment like that, we have to then help families to be families. And that means having great quality nurseries, because there's nothing worse than, you know, the standard being so low, and that actually we ended up with, you know, children suffering as a consequence of economic decisions that are made that put families in really awkward positions. And then our children suffer because you send them to somewhere that's not suitable or that's not good enough. So we have a real discussion to be had with the public Why on earth do you think, Catherine, we haven't got that discussion out there? Why aren't people worked up about that? And why aren't people like, it's a feminist issue as far as I'm concerned as well. And as feminists, why the hell haven't we got to a point where childcare is great quality, accessible, and the right of every parent to use if they want to? Why haven't we got to that point?
I think it's a million dollar question, isn't it? I think you're completely right to say that, you know, maybe we should be a bit self-reflective. We with a very broad we, you know, as a sector haven't been terribly good at drawing those threads together. You know, we mm-hmm. tend to plough our own furrow, you know, seeing it either as a women's rights issue or as a children's rights issue or as a anti-poverty issue, or, you know, I think maybe we need to be a bit self-reflective and think, you know, and I think you're right to lay down a challenge to us as someone, you know, as an organisation who claims to bring people together, to think about what our role is in doing that. But I think you're right. I think as a society, I think we never had sight of the value of childcare and those sort of dual values. I wonder if the sort of post-COVID recovery mm-hmm. narrative does provide some kind of opportunity, you know, if you know, certainly I keep a good eye on what the GLA and London Council is doing in terms of their London Recovery Programme. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, effort to get London back up and running, get the wheels back on the bus, as it were, get the city firing on all cylinders again. I think there is perhaps an opportunity for us to say childcare is absolutely an essential part. You know, it's just as essential as us having a functioning tube system. It's important to the, you know, life of our city to have a childcare infrastructure that matches that. Maybe not the less reliable sort of parts of the Northern Line, but overall, I think, you know, maybe there is a bit of opportunity to get to some different actors to think about their role. I mean, I think, you know, think about sort of the private sector and the role of big business in a city. You know, I'm not sure that those people, probably mostly very well-paid men, are thinking an awful lot about how the people working in their organisations, particularly the ones they pay the worst, at the, you know, to clean their offices, where their children are while mothers are doing those jobs. And I think perhaps, you know, that is a kind of way for us to sort of think about it again, but without absolutely losing the sight of the fact that this is a should be child-focused, child-centred, is a children's rights issue as well. And actually, you know, in terms of reducing the attainment gap, which is frighteningly large by the time children reach, you know, school age, we won't be sort of addressing inequality and disadvantage unless we tackle that. And that, you know, high quality childcare and early education has a huge part to play in that too. So it's I guess it's really complicated, and maybe, you know, public discourse doesn't deal with complexity very well, but I think it is incumbent on us to really try and get that conversation going.
So it's a call to action then, really, to big public companies and big PR companies and big marketing companies to join the alliance, really, and put their skills of storytelling and amplifying stories to work, really, because that's what we need, isn't it?
Yeah,
we need a really good campaign mm-hmm. that is, you know, is secured by case studies and stories, that is, you know, is enormously important in telling the story exactly as you laid it out. And, you know, it's not simply about parents, it's not simply about society. Childcare is an infrastructure issue, we know, but what does it mean for a child, and actually tell those stories? So I'm going to put that on your manifesto ask then. So how do we do that, and how do you get, you know, Saatchi and Saatchi or whoever it is, these big PR companies behind you, to actually tell a story? Because that's what we need, isn't it?
Yeah, that would be fantastic. If they're listening, if anyone is listening to the podcast, then, you know, I have a hotline right to you, please.
I write a hotline to Catherine. And also, when you go back to the GLA, because I do think the GLA is trying know, I do really think it's trying that actually you could ask them that instead of wasting money on some terrible campaigns that drive no benefit, of which they're a number, that actually they redirect the money to you. So that actually we can set up a big campaign that is on billboards and cinemas and out there. And, you know, and that it's Fiona Bruce on Question Time actually bothers to invite someone to talk about this issue as opposed to some of the, you know, topics that fixate them, which are meaningless and they don't drive any systemic change to our lives and to the lives of all our children and our future citizens. So so that's my call to action. I'm very clear about that. So just to conclude then, Catherine, is there any kind of message you want to leave your readers with and any call to actions, apart from the fact that we're going to make sure they get access to the manifesto?
Absolutely. I think also just maybe just ask them what they, when they've had a chance to digest the manifesto, what we'll hopefully be also be able to do is give you some sort of practical steps and hints to sort of how you might use the manifesto to have conversations locally with any local councillors who might come knocking on your door, to have a series of questions about the manifesto to put to them. You know, we would encourage people to kind of, you know, we're covering all our member organisations to try and make contact with the would-be councillors in their locality to sort of challenge them to sign up to the pledge. The more contact we can have, the more councillors who will sort of publicly say that this is a priority for them, that, you know, we can continue to have that ongoing contact with them, hold them accountable to that, and ask them how they're progressing with sort of putting the pledges in place. So there will be, alongside the manifesto is, you know, hopefully a ambitious vision of what we might want to happen, but I think it's about what people do with it really that's going to matter. It's about having those conversations. The more people can have conversations about these issues that we've been discussing, the more it will begin to register that this is what people really want to see action on. And some of the polling we did in the report I was talking about earlier was really crystal clear that people at all level of the income distribution want to see politicians doing more to tackle child poverty. It is something that people are really concerned about. And they will support greater change, and I think probably more than the government might think.
Well, thank you for that. That's pretty clear. So to anyone listening and sharing, you get hold of the manifesto, you write to your MP, you write to your local councillor, and if anyone deigns to come to your front door, and I've seen absolutely nobody come to our door about local council elections, then you give them one and you get them to sign up to and pledge to it. And in the meantime, you just start distributing it everywhere. And actually, one of the benefits of this is that you might actually end up knowing that you have a local councillor, you might even know their name. So all in all, win-win. So thank you again to Catherine for actually bringing some life to this really deep and can be quite distressing topic. Some of the statistics you need to go away and think about, guys, and have them bang in your head. You know, 4 in 10 children, 86,000 children in temporary accommodation. These are significant numbers, and the implication of child poverty on those children and the kind of how it reflects outwards. It's like that whole ripple effect is really, really significant. So you might feel it doesn't touch you immediately, but it will touch you in some way, shape or form. It always does. So that's it from Talking Early Years today. And again, big thank you to Catherine from the London Child Poverty Action Group, and we'll be back in another few weeks with another podcast with a surprise guest. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Jean.
Thank you for joining me today. If you like what you heard, please share it or check us out on our website, leaf.org.uk.